Ahval podcastlerini tüm mobil telefonlarda Spotify, SoundCloud ve Spreaker üzerinden dinleyebilirsiniz. Apple iPhone kullanıcıları bize iTunes üzerinden de ulaşabilir. Türkiye'nin ve hayatın cıvıl cıvıl sesleri Ahval Podcast dizisinde. Kulağınız bizde olsun.
Hello, welcome to the Hot Pursuit. We are going to discuss several current foreign affairs issues from Cyprus to Nagorno-Karabakh, as well as some domestic developments today. To discuss these issues today, we are with the editor-in-chief of Ahval, Yavuz Baydar. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Ilhan.
Let's start from domestic affairs, some more freedom issues today, press freedom issues. First of all, Can Dündar, a Turkish court today ordered the seizure of all of assets of Can Dündar, exiled journalist. This is kind of a follow-up coming from a couple of weeks ago, the judge ordered or the prosecutor demanded and judge granted today. Also, there are other journalists today and yesterday have been jailed from Kurdish journalists reporting on eastern villages in Turkey, or the other journalists in Ankara and Istanbul. This has been the cycle, have been going on quite for some time. What to make of this?
Well, Ilhan, things are speeding up, really, regarding Turkey. It's a lot of developments at the same time. Such a moving target. Very hard for us to cope to cover it, actually, as Ahval. As you notice, you as the executive editor of Ahval English, I as editor in chief, we are having a hard time. And every day we wake up to, you know, you may say unexpected, or you may also say expected developments regarding Turkey, which is the epicenter of all sorts of mismanagement in terms of political approach or also foreign policy approach. We, towards the noon Turkish time, we received a news piece that reports that Can Dündar, our colleague, based in Germany now, in exile, his assets were seized by the authorities. His assets, meaning four real estates, one apartment in Bodrum, one in Istanbul, and two apparently adjacent locals in Ankara belonging to the couple, Dündar couple. This was completely unexpected. I mean, this belongs to the unexpected, because when I was corresponding with Can yesterday about what to expect from this upcoming trial regarding seizure and appointment of government trustee, he sent me a note saying the trial is postponed to October 14. And that was yesterday, October 6, this conversation or this communication took place. And this came to me as completely unexpected. I said, what is going on here? Because usually when the court announces a date, it is a date. It is an announced and fixed date. Apparently, as we hear from some further reports, cover-up, follow-up reports from our younger reporters from Diken website, the judge newly appointed to that very court took the initiative, and without informing Can Dündar's lawyers, defense lawyers, sort of decided to hold the decisive court today. Court and a ruling came immediately after. So it means that there is a sort of acceleration or speeding up of the process, de facto, de facto stepping on anything that has to do with the law or legalities, and it's a fait accompli in many from whichever aspects you look at. So this decision is made, and the government appointee trustee is appointed, and the assets are seized, which is, of course, I imagine is expected by Can and Dilek Dündar, to a great disappointment of them. And it is, of course, a new phase, and nobody can really guess what is going to happen with these seized properties. Former practice, ever since the attempted coup, shows that many of those properties are, after confiscation, are sold or transferred to the treasury. Many of them, not all of them. And this actually is not the first time it is happening. It has happened before. One of our colleagues based in Sweden, Ragıp Zarakoğlu, a columnist with Artı Gerçek, he's very well known in terms of being a publisher of books about the Armenian genocide. Recently, a couple of months ago, he broke the news that his assets were confiscated. Formerly also, Aykan Erdemir, a former deputy with the main opposition, CHP, based now in Washington, D.C., as you are, or you are where you are, and with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, his assets were also frozen some time ago, I think a year and a half ago, if I remember correctly. And there are others, for example, the former football player Hakan Şükür, whose father's assets, again, were confiscated, on and on. So what makes this recent, you know, latest case with Dündar is, of course, very spectacular. It makes it much more exposed what is happening with the property rights or violation of, massive violation of property rights in Turkey, which has been in culmination since 2016. So I imagine more to expect because the pressure valve on pressure on journalists is increasing as we speak. As you mentioned in your introduction, Mesopotamian News Agency, one of our very fertile sources of news and information, whose office in Van was raided by police, because that was one office of Mesopotamia News Agency that broke the news about two Kurdish peasants thrown out of a chopper, and one of them died. Apparently, as we see it, as a sort of a revenge operation to close that office, and some members of or staff members of the agency are now under arrest, probably for a long time. And also, together with the news about Can Dündar, we heard also news broken about Ayşegül Doğan, an esteemed colleague, Kurdish colleague, who was very active in establishing Kurdish media in Turkey for many, many years. She's now being accused of terror propaganda or whatnot for up to 15 years of imprisonment. So this is an ongoing story, a never-ending story about our profession. And we will continue to follow that and cover that as much as we can.
Okay, every time we think that things cannot get worse in Turkey, bleaker, we see another morning and things indeed get worse.
I will also add something about the case of property rights, which is the sacred right, you know, of the Western civilization. Not only that, but also, I mean, the main pillar of Western civilization elsewhere as well. So property rights has never been shed light on, under the spotlight in the past 4 years. There have been cases brought to the European Court of Human Rights, and property rights clause in European Treaty of Human Rights is one of the most visited and decided upon clauses. So as we reported in Ahval, more or less an estimated value of confiscated and seized assets, private assets or company assets in Turkey since the botched coup, go up to $32+ billion. And apparently, we will do a lot of coverage of things in European Court of Human Rights in the coming months and years, probably.
I see. And foreign affairs, this weekend, upcoming weekend, there'll be elections in Turkish. There are two main figures. One of them is president of the Turkish Cyprus, Mustafa Akıncı. And the other one is prime minister, current prime minister, Ersin Tatar. What to expect from these elections and why these elections are important for the region?
Well, it has now become a hot issue, another hot issue. Again, in the context of the crisis in the Eastern Mediterranean, North Cyprus is a breakaway republic, as you know, and recognized only by Turkey, where there is a native Turkish community. This has been per se a well-functioning democracy because of the traditions. I think that has a lot to do with Cyprus being a sort of a colony of the British Empire. It has a rock-solid judiciary tradition, which is still independent, both in south, yes, but also in the north. And also freely, fairly held elections, despite the fact that the North Cyprus is under fire, internationally speaking. And also there's an unresolved huge conflict which divides the island. And also there is also growing Turkish mainland, Ankara, frustration now culminating because of the problematic import of Cyprus into European Union without its conflict resolved for forever. So it was sort of a, you know, importation of a country with all its problems into the body of European Union, if you will. But these elections are critical because on Sunday there are two main candidates. There's a third one. There is Akıncı, there is Tatar, and there's Hürerman. And it seems Tatar and Hürerman have almost on equal chances to be the... It's a two-tier, first of all. No survey expects the decision or choice being made in the first tier. Probably it will be Akıncı for sure, nearly for sure, passing to the second tier. But whether or not it will be Tatar or Hürerman, nobody has any clear idea. Although Tatar is now being enforced or endorsed rather by Ankara to race on equal terms with Akıncı. And what happened is that there have been reports in North Cyprus press, which is a free press, by the way, very pluralistic and free, has always been, in a newspaper called Özgür, which means free. There were photographies, pictures, and reports on the front page saying that Turkey's vice president, Fuat Oktay, with a delegation, had settled in one of the luxury hotels in Girne. And there he was sort of on constant setting up a base as advisory to Tatar and his team to make him win. It's a big delegation, as newspaper claimed. These claims were never confirmed by the other side, nor denied really. And everybody knows that Oktay's press secretary is there, has been there for some time. So after this breaking of news, things have gotten really more tense. And then Today is Wednesday, October 7. Yesterday, in an unexpected move, Ersin Tatar appeared in Ankara, Turkish capital, together with Turkish President Erdogan, in a live press conference and transmission from North Cyprus, from Varosha area, which has been closed since 1974. And as I am told by our colleagues, our Turk-Cypriot colleagues, it was a spectacular and very, to the deputies of North Cyprus, very irritating show. In that, Tatar was quite submissive, appeared submissive, silent, and Erdogan very active and dominant, even telling the cameras where to turn the cameras, etc. The show was about opening a road to the beach of Varosha. So apparently the announcement is only to open the beach of the closed Varosha to the public. No more than that. But that per se was enough to cause a lot of reactions from United Nations, European Union. Josep Borrell had used a quite a harsh language, saying that Turkey was directly intervening in the upcoming elections, and also Moscow. Russia issued a quite a harsh statement, saying that it is naming certain United Nations Security Council resolutions, one after another. All of these are contradicting the move about opening partly or as a in full Varosha area. So it has now triggered another spot in sort of crisis in the Eastern Mediterranean. First it was Aegean, then it was off Castellorizo, and now then it was you know, Cyprus Republic, South Cyprus, south of South Cyprus coast, and now it is North Cyprus. Whether or not the elections will be going to the January second tier, it seems quite clear. But Tatar is being endorsed quite powerfully and will continue to be to do so, apparently. And we will see what happens. But the situation is very tense. And also, as a move reflecting that irritation in North Cyprus, one party, Halkın Partisi, Party of the People, which is part of the coalition, current coalition in North Cyprus, pulled out of the coalition, citing that it has the government of Kudret Özersay, which is the leader of the coalition, was not at all informed about this Varosha move, nor about Ersin Tatar's appearance. And it it was very upset about this this situation. So they decided to pull out. So it's sort of a lame duck government, but it's a very small area. So it is it has the luxury of continuing even beyond the elections. So we will see. But situation is very tense in North Cyprus.
So we will be covering and following up the these elections on Sunday. And viewers certainly welcome to Ahval to follow the elections and the results, at least the first round. And then we'll see how it goes from there.
It is and more important than it appears to be, actually, for the entire, again, the context of Eastern Mediterranean crisis. It will have repercussions and some perhaps unexpected consequences, this election.
Yes. And the final issue today, like to talk about the Nagorno-Karabakh. It has been, I think, today's 10th day. The conflict clashes have been going on. Both sides, Azerbaijan and Armenia, have been accusing each other for targeting civilian centers, civilian cities. Today, talks involving Russia, France and the United States will be held in Geneva today, just announced, I think. And then on Monday, it will be continued in Moscow. These talks obviously aim to find some kind of ceasefire, whether permanent or temporary. Turkey so far perhaps is the only actor for the conflict has been objecting to ceasefire, and President Erdogan has been calling on Armenia to withdraw from the Azerbaijani territories, as Mr. Erdogan says, otherwise the fight will continue. What do you see there?
Well, I'll leave the final comments about the overall regional Turkish patterns to the end of our conversation, Ilan. But what happens is apparently in the 10th day, the atrocities began 27th of September, as you remember, which then escalated day after another. And now it was a long wait, actually. A lot of observers were waiting for Russia to move in, diplomatically speaking. But it delayed and delayed. France was before Russia. Iran, France, European Union, the States, they all called for ceasefire to no avail. But now it seems, with today's announcement, it seems Paris and Moscow got synchronized. They opened a new page together as co-chairs of Minsk Group. Now, these talks beginning tomorrow in Geneva, which will be held in October 8, and then continuing in Moscow, means probably it will be under the umbrella of Minsk Group, because these two capitals, Paris and Moscow, are keen on to at least see to it that the ceasefire applies. There are also confirming signs from Baku. Erdogan was yesterday and in Baku today, saying that Baku, Aliyev was saying, if Armenia stops shooting in Karabakh area, we are ready to talk. And yesterday, Pashinyan was also only a sort of complaining about and warning about Azeri, what he calls Azeri aggression, but he was not really defiant or stubborn about continuing to fight. So I think both sides now seem to have come to a point of fatigue, if you will, with the intervention of France and Russia. I think what we will see in the first phase is to speak about the modalities of ceasefire without the intervention of United States, which is the third co-chair, but United States of America these days is another completely a different chapter now, because it is completely focused on elections, and it has showed quite clearly that it will remain aloof to the conflict of Nagorno-Karabakh and Caucasus in general. So the job is up to Paris and Moscow, Putin and Macron. And probably it will take some time. What I think interesting part will be, we could expect a ceasefire being declared quite soon. But interesting part will be what will happen afterwards, because there are two things. There is the status, unresolved status of Nagorno-Karabakh and occupied territories by Armenia. And second, what will happen with the Turkish involvement, with the stance of Erdogan and Bahçeli alliance in Ankara, how it will react to these developments? Will it continue to boost an Azeri offensive or not? How Ankara will react to this, we haven't seen yet, but there will certainly be a reaction from Turkish capital. And from then on, we will see whether or not what many foreign observers see as Turkish, Erdogan's Turkey destabilizing the entire region will continue to rise as perception or not. So this is where we are in general. I think Karabakh conflict, at least the hostilities now, are about to fade in a sort of slow motion manner, most probably.
And we have not heard much from Washington while the Minsk group co-chairs Moscow and Paris will be overseeing these talks. Not sure what Washington, whether Washington, I am sure Washington will have some kind of representation at the table, absolutely, but we don't see anything from the White House or State Department.
These talks will not be happening without any American representation, certainly, because Minsk Group is Minsk Group, and it is going to continue to call the shots regarding Nagorno-Karabakh. We will see that. But again, the big question mark is whether or not the so-called Lavrov plan will be, you know, put on the table again, sort of forcing Armenia to give up some of the occupied territories around Karabakh in a timetable, how it will develop, what will Azeri side demand, how far it will go, whether or not both sides will stick to their maximalist positions or not. It will be a difficult phase. You know, time has shown that conflict resolution in that part of the world has been quite an uphill battle. So we will see what happens. Again, the most unclear part is, of course, what will happen with Ankara's involvement. Again, this is there has been an active Turkish involvement through confirmed presence of the Syrian mercenaries and jihadists. There have been more than 55 funerals taking place in the area. So by that event, series of events, there have been confirmations that there was foreign involvement of exported Syrian paid soldiers or militia or jihadists. That will be an issue between Turkey and Russia. That will continue to be an issue. And as we see it, the Turkish-Russian relations are getting more and more and more tense. Absolutely. This is this may come to a point where it's very hard to manage. Because for Erdogan, given the acceleration of the crisis at home, particularly in economy, as we see, you know, Turkish lira gaining ground, losing ground day after day, hour after hour, and also not having gained any ground in terms of involvement in different crises in the region, it may be a big challenge for the side of Putin to deal with that kind of situation. For Erdogan, it may be a choice to continue to get involved until the day after the American elections, and even between the American elections and until the inauguration of the American president in January. These months will be extremely tense, sensitive, delicate for the world to see. What happened? I will end there with the Turkish involvement in the region, with Syria, beginning with Iraq, Syria, Libya. It has all been, as put by one main opposition, Turkish main opposition deputy, former diplomat, senior diplomat, Mr. Ünal Çevik was in parliament yesterday, that there has been no gains at all. And I think he used the phrase, he said the Turkish foreign policy has lost everything in terms of a compass. And it is only bringing loss after loss after loss, what we call solitude, which is increasing, which is a solitude that is cementing in the region. Turkey has been left empty-handed regarding Libya. It is in a very fragile position in Idlib, in northwest of Syria, vis-a-vis Russian forces. And it has been exposed quite clearly in Nagorno-Karabakh or southern Caucasus. and it has been blocked quite clearly by the European Union regarding Eastern Mediterranean. So that is where we are regarding the Turkish foreign policy moves. And this all makes everything continuing to be very interesting, let's say.
And quite complicated. Thank you so much for your time. That's it for today, but it seems like we are going to continue discussing all these different issues on whether Turkish foreign affairs or domestic affairs next time.
Thank you.
See you. Thank you.
Ahval podcastlerini tüm mobil telefonlarda Spotify, SoundCloud ve Spreaker üzerinden dinleyebilirsiniz. Apple iPhone kullanıcıları bize iTunes üzerinden de ulaşabilir. Türkiye'nin ve hayatın cıvıl cıvıl sesleri Ahval Podcast dizisinde. Kulağınız bizde olsun.